Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moscowane. Rehab facilities are a beacon of hope for millions of addicts and their families. They offer the promise of a new sober life, a fresh start. But for many addicts, rehab is a revolving door. They go in and out of these centers and don't seem to get the treatment they need to stay sober. So what exactly happens inside of these facilities? And are the treatments offered effective? In her book, Inside Rehab, journalist Anne Fletcher offers readers a close-up look at addiction treatment in America. She visited centers all over the country and spoke with counselors and clients, and she joins us today on Radio Times. Anne, thank you so much for being here.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
Thank you. We're also joined by Thomas McClellan and Adam Brooks from the Treatment Research Institute here in Philadelphia. McClellan is the CEO and co-founder, and Brooks is a senior scientist. So thanks to both of you for being here.
Glad to be here.
Yep.
And Anne, let's start with you. How big an industry is rehabilitation in the U.S.?
Oh, it's very big. There's many, 13 to 14 thousand rehabs, treatment centers. And when I say rehab, I'm talking about both outpatient programs and inpatient programs, what we think of as rehab, residential treatment. But about 90% of treatment in this country is really outpatient, where people go during the day for any number of hours and come home at night. But the reality is, what really inspired me to write the book was not only getting to know Dr. McClellan and his findings of many shortcomings in the treatment system, but also the fact that we have 22 million people in this country with some kind of serious drug or alcohol problem, and only about 1 out of 10 of these people actually goes for help. And I really wanted to develop a better understanding of why that is. And there are many reasons for that, but I firmly believe, particularly after doing my research, that it has a lot to do with the shortcomings of our system. As you said, I really felt that somebody needed to go inside and get a better understanding of what goes on, and that's what I did.
Now, you just mentioned outpatient versus inpatient. Describe briefly the difference between those two.
Well, we think there's different kinds of each, but in general, residential treatment is where you go away and you live there for any length of time. The typical model is to go away for 28 to 30 days for residential treatment, where you're, I found, in some kind of group treatment, typically with a group, in group counseling, group movies, lectures, some kind of group. Sometimes there's meditation groups, that kind of thing, for about 8 hours a day. That's not including meals. Very little individual counseling. That's the typical model for group treatment. There's some AA meetings or introduction to AA. That's typically what goes on in residential treatment. And you sleep there. And there may be some medical management that goes on, too. There usually is in a better rehab, in a more high-end rehab. Outpatient treatment is typically where you go. It depends on the intensity. It can be more hours or less hours, but it's typically a couple of hours of treatment several days a week, where you go and then you go home at night, or you might go back to your job. And the research shows, actually, contrary to what most people believe, that outpatient treatment is just as effective as residential treatment, and many experts I interviewed believe that residential treatment should really be reserved for the select few. And that's really contrary to a lot of what we see in the media and what people are led to believe.
Let me turn to Tom McClellan. You wrote the introduction for this book. What do we know about what's effective when it comes to rehab? How long have we been studying that?
Well, even though addiction is the latest, the most recent part of healthcare, we know an awful lot. We know a lot about what can work. But the system, as Anne has found, is not geared to providing it. We don't treat it. It's a chronic illness, first of all, and we, as you heard, it's being treated in a series of acute care episodes. It's not very effective. I think residential care is almost, it's quite necessary, but it's simply not sufficient. For chronic illness, you don't have, think about diabetes, for example. You don't have a 30-day program you go to for diabetes. It wouldn't work. It couldn't work. It's a chronic illness. You have to keep changing your life, monitoring, managing, medicating sometimes, And that's the kind of treatment that can work in addiction.
What should happen during a residential stay in terms of how somebody thinks about their life? What are the initial steps that need to happen? Maybe Adam or Tom, who wants to weigh in on that?
Go right ahead.
The way that the rehabs are often set up and is that the client may be, through the rehab experience, may be inducted into Alcoholics Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous or get experience with other 12-step fellowships. And that is maybe one aspect of care that could be helpful to some patients. And, you know, we all know many, many colleagues, friends, patients that have really benefited from that. But it doesn't help everybody. And with rehabs that are often structured very single-mindedly towards a 12-step or a 12-step recovery lifestyle, it means that other options that might be beneficial to the client may not be introduced or discussed to the degree that they need to be. So if you ask me, one thing that really needs to happen at any level of rehab care, whether it's outpatient or inpatient, is a thorough discussion with the patient about treatment options and the range of treatment options available to them should be made. One of those things that's really underused is medication. You know, we have FDA-approved medications for treating both alcoholism and for heroin, opiate, painkiller addictions. These treatment options are really underused. I have tended to find that they are more underutilized at the inpatient level in a traditional rehab than on an outpatient level. Not to say that they couldn't be introduced there, but I just don't see that they're introduced as often as they ought to be.
And this is something...
To give a
yes.
number, only about 20% of programs nationwide use FDA-approved medications that we know help people with alcohol dependence, or what most people call alcoholism. It's very sad. So, he's right. I mean, Adam and I agree on a lot of things.
And what do you think is the thinking? Is that you don't want to replace one addiction with another? What's the thinking in not offering these medications?
Yeah, I think it's old-fashioned thinking. I think it's lack of knowledge. I went to one outpatient program, where I mentioned the name of a science-based medication that's been known for many years. I asked if it was used. I asked the director of a program if it was used, and she didn't even know what it was. So I think sometimes it's just lack of education, and it's appalling. There are alternative groups, support groups to AA that have a different philosophy that help many people when AA doesn't work. AA is great when it works, but 5 to 8 out of 10 people who are encouraged to go to AA while they attend treatment will stop attending AA in less than a year. So, and the problem is that people aren't usually told about other options, like Smart Recovery, Women for Sobriety, maybe encouraged to get support from a church group. There's many, many different ways to get support. So the problem is when you're not told about other options. And the sad thing to me was, you know, I interviewed hundreds of people who had, not only staff people who had worked at rehabs, but people who had been through rehab recently. And when they were told, they went to the same treatment over and over again. And usually it was 12-step focused, and when you were talking about what works, one of the saddest stories was a woman who had been to this model of treatment where the focus was on getting her to accept the 12 steps, and this woman desperately wanted to overcome her alcoholism. And she died of liver failure after years and years of this kind of treatment. And the mother of the daughter told me the story. It was so sad because the mother looked into the girl's treatment and the reasons for her death afterwards, and she said, here's this girl who had all these fancy assessments at these rehabs to identify her problems, which were many, not just alcoholism, co-occurring psychiatric problems. When you said, what works? We need to address those in addition to addiction. They were never addressed at any of the many rehabs she went to. She was never given any medications for her alcoholism. And she continued to drink because her other problems weren't addressed. Family therapy, marital and family therapy. She had a lot of deep sadness over her relationship with her father. It was never addressed. So there are lots of things that we know that work that often are not addressed in rehabs.
That's Ann Fletcher. She's written a new book. This is her eighth. It's called Inside Rehab. We're also joined by Tom McClellan and Adam Brooks from the Treatment Research Institute in Philadelphia. Tom, what do we know? Who does 12 steps? Who does it work for? It works for a lot of people.
It works for a lot of people. It is the most. There are currently about as many people in stable recovery as there are addicted people. And most of those people get into recovery directly through AA or some 12-step. But I'd like to go back. It is easy to talk about the failings of this system, and they should be talked about. I congratulate you on the show. But it's wrong to blame any one group. The model was set up 40 years ago when nobody knew anything about the science of addiction. They thought it was a bad habit. They thought it was bad parenting. They thought it was bad character.
And nobody wanted to treat addicts.
And exactly.
Right,
they were not people falling over themselves pleading to treat addicts, absolutely. So they made places out in the country to get people away. And the other part was that it was widely believed that the only people who could break through the kinds of personality problems and everything that an addict would have would be other addicts. So it wasn't coincidence that there weren't medications, doctors, professionals. It was thought that that was the best. If you look at other illnesses, same thing was thought of tuberculosis, for example. So what Ann says is absolutely right. There's such a lot of new science, new approaches, and new ways of doing it. Now all we need is for the insurance industry and popular demand to catch up with it and demand the kind of quality care that you could get.
You could imagine the system learning to adapt, adopt, and coexist with a lot of these new treatments,
sure.
But it will demand real change. I mean, this, in fact, is a really exciting time in the field because we have two really important pieces of legislation that can change the system. You know, we have the Affordable Care Act, which is going to ensure a lot more people and provide a lot more flexibility in the kind of care that people with mental health and substance abuse disorders have. And we have the Parity Act, which passed before that, which ensures that people with mental health and substance abuse treatments with insurance plans, that though the benefits there have to be offered. And there's a lot of room to rewrite those regulations so that, you know, we get science-based, evidence-based care that honors the traditions and the things that work from 12-step and you know, doesn't exclude that, but then also equips rehabs. I mean, I think one of the big issues is a lot of rehabs, they've been underfunded, they're understaffed, they are constantly under the gun to cut from their workforce to do more with less, basically. So to have a nurse or a doctor on staff that could prescribe these medications, a lot of them don't have it available.
Right.
It's not really, you know, it's not like they're just dismissing these options out of hand. I think there's several factors that push together to keep rehabs from adopting them.
All right. One of the things that's
you
really
know what,
amazing.
I'm sorry, we are coming up on a break, so I hate to interrupt you, but
yep.
Hold that thought, and we'll get to that in a moment. We're talking about addiction treatment in America, and we'll be back after a short break. If you want to join our conversation, our number is 1-888-477-9499. Again, that's 1-888-477-9499. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moskowain, and you're listening to Radio Times. We'll be right back with more.
Temple University Libraries support WHYY and invite you to lectures exploring the American idea. The series continues this Thursday, February 21st, with an exploration of Main Street America. Future programs look at women's history, immigration, the poet Walt Whitman, drinking in America, and more. The details are all online at library.temple.edu. These are open to the public with no ticket required. Complete schedule at library.temple.edu.
Singing, hey, hey, mama, can your daddy come home?
Next time in Studio 360, some advice from the country music superstar Dwight Yoakam.
Man can't really steal your field of wheat overnight, but he can sure take a lot of sheep, cattle.
Dwight Yoakam on music, movies, and agriculture. That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
Adults aren't the only people who are struggling with their weight, but what does a mother do when her young child is losing the battle and a normal healthy diet doesn't work? We'll talk with a mom who took some radical steps and took plenty of grief for it. Plus, we'll ask a roundtable of parents to weigh in. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moskowain, and we're talking about addiction treatment. Our guest is Anne Fletcher. She has written Inside Rehab, The Surprising Truth About Addiction Treatment and How to Get Help That Works. We're also joined by addiction researchers Thomas McClellan and Adam Brooks, and they are both with the Treatment Research Institute in Philadelphia. And Anne, before our break, we were talking about the disconnect between research and what happens in practice, and you were just about to respond to that, so go ahead.
Yeah, well, I wanted to say that, you know, I don't just talk in my book about things that are broken in the system. I talk about, I'm not just the bearer of bad news.
No,
I give people lots of tips and advice for finding something, how to find good treatment to meet your needs. And I also profile programs that are doing things in a positive way, that are using science-based treatment. And when we were talking about affordability and low-income programs, and even though both Adam and Tom and Adam, we're on a first-name basis. I'm a Philly girl, and Dr. McClellan and Dr. Brooks helped connect me with some low-income programs that I visited in the Philadelphia area. And even though many of them are beleaguered financially and short on staff, there are programs out there that are doing tremendous work. One of them I visited in the Philly area. I visited everything from celebrity rehabs to high-end 12-step-based programs to programs that treat indigent people. And one of the most surprising findings that really amazes people, and it amazed me, is that some community-based programs, those programs in your neighborhood that treat low-income people and that you could go to, too, even if you're not a low-income person, are providing more evidence-based treatment, science-based treatment with high-quality staff than some of the fancy rehabs. One of the reasons for that is they're often funded through government grants that require science-based treatment, master's degree counselors. I'm not saying all community-based programs are terrific. There's high-level and low-level programs at all levels of the financial spectrum, but they're terrific community-based programs out there.
Let me ask, what works in addiction treatment? We talk a lot about evidence-based treatments and what should be in place. So what are some of these programs, Tom?
I'll start with the things that you should. If you're a purchaser or a person who refers, you are wasting your money if you simply get detoxification or any other short-term treatment. It is a chronic illness. It needs to be managed. You're going to need help to change your life. So the things that help you and your family to change your life and continue to keep that change over time are the things that are going to give you good value for your dollar and that science has shown to be effective. So they are medications. They are therapies by trained, capable people, especially individual, less so group. Community supports, family and couples training, these are the things that are most effective.
So should we think about rehab as kind of a kickstart on your path to sobriety?
It can be.
But not the be-all, end-all.
It's not the be-all, end-all. I think because what Tom, the things that Tom are talking about are things that have to unfold in a continuum over time. We should stop thinking about care like 30 days or 90 days. Oh, they're finally out of rehab. Oh, they can start their life again. No, you're starting your life at the point that you start treatment. You're restarting or kickstarting it again. But think months, years for recovery, where the amount of care and contact
in
an outpatient setting, where the amount of care and contact that the patient is getting is stepped down to the level that it's still helpful to them, not annoying, and that they will remain engaged with. So
it doesn't mean you're going 3 hours, three times a week
absolutely.
For 5 years. You might be seeing an individual therapist once a week.
Yeah,
that
or even once a month at a point.
Many people.
And you describe in your book the different therapies that have found to work. One of them is cognitive behavioral therapy. How does that work? Describe it.
Well, it's really looking at the cues and triggers in your life, both environmental, like, you know, going a certain route, driving a certain route home from work, you know, where you're driving past the bar that you always passed, and that's a trigger. So your therapist might suggest taking a different route home from work. Certain thought patterns and behaviors. I just watched one of the Oscar-nominated films last night, and a certain song drove a guy's behavior. You know, if there's a song that you associate with drinking or using drugs, You know, you would learn to respond to that and your anger and your emotional triggers in new ways. That's what cognitive behavioral therapy does. There are certain family-based treatments that we know are effective. CRAFT, community reinforcement and family training, is very effective for getting people into treatment, far more so than classic interventions like those we see on TV, and probably would be effective, there's some research going on, in helping people with relapse using those approaches. I only found one of the 15 programs I visited to be using that science-based approach. Most of them are using psychoeducational family weeks, which really don't have a scientific basis.
And speaking of which, you also describe several approaches that are still very popular, continue to be used, but do not work. What are some of those?
Educational lectures and films. Hundreds of studies show that these are among the least effective ways to treat alcohol problems, and they're used over and over again.
I was also surprised to read that you say dwelling on the past tends not to be so effective, yet it seems to be kind of a hallmark of AA meetings where you talk about the things you've done.
I would say less AA meetings than the group kind of counseling that you get in a lot of these programs. It's facile to do, but it's wholly useless.
And it's important to make the distinction that AA is not treatment. AA is a self-help group, and a lot of people don't understand that. Treatment programs use AA, but AA is not treatment.
Yeah. Sorry, go ahead, Tom. Why is that not helpful to talk about?
Because you got the rest of your life to go forward, which you really need. If you want to take a good look at the kind of things that are going to be helpful in the future for addiction treatment, take a look now at how they're managing diabetes, asthma, hypertension, and other chronic illnesses. They're managing with a team approach. It's prospective. It is anticipatory. They know when there are going to be relapses. They know what the things are going to trigger all the symptoms of those illnesses. Like those other illnesses, there's a large genetic component, but it's not totally genetic. It's behavioral. And healthcare is being restructured so that teams can help individuals and their support groups change those behaviors and maintain those changes. That's what is the cheapest. That's what's the most satisfying. It's the way of the future.
Well, I think, Ann mentioned this statistic that, only 1 out of 10 people who need treatment get it. And part of it is because we don't have. We have treatment, and treatment is largely designed for people who are the worst of the worst in the severity of their addiction. We don't have these more flexible options for people who just think, I'm a little worried about my drinking. I'd like to talk to somebody about this. A lot of mental health clinicians probably have the ability, have the ability to handle these, but because it comes in as a substance use issue, a lot of times they feel like it's out of my area of expertise. I'm going to send this person to their specialty rehab in the community where the treatment has been built to handle more severe cases.
I'd like to comment on that. Just imagine what the treatment of, let's say, diabetes would look like in this country if it had the same insurance plan that addiction has. Only diabetics who had lost a finger or perhaps their eyesight would be eligible for care. There would be no prevention. There'd be no nutritional counseling. There'd be no primary care doctors handling it. That wouldn't have been taught in school. That's exactly what we've bought in this country. We've got the care that was purchased with the ideas and the dollars and the ideology of the 1960s and 70s. We simply haven't updated it.
I don't mind saying that I was one of those people that Dr. Brooks described. I'll back up and say that the point he was making is that substance problems, particularly alcohol problems, fall on a huge continuum. We have everything from relatively minor to moderate to very severe. Most people with substance problems, drug and alcohol problems, fall in the mild to moderate category. There are people sitting next to you at work and at church. They're functioning, maybe not perfectly, obviously not perfectly, in their daily lives. I was one of those people. When I was drinking, I was jogging 5 miles a day. My life wasn't perfect, and it was causing problems in my life. I was thriving in my career, but there was no place for me to go because treatment programs in this country are designed to treat the very small minority of people with very severe problems. So the point that our experts are making is that we need to have in place something, and many psychologists, as Dr. Brooks said, have the skills, but they tend to say, well, these people have a substance problem, they belong over there, but they really, people with mild to moderate substance problems don't belong in treatment programs. We have nothing to treat those people.
And what did you do to get better?
I suffered alone for many years. I tried AA. I didn't fit there. I finally made phone call after phone call and found individual therapist, a psychologist, a doctoral-level psychologist who had expertise with addictions, because many of them don't know anything about substance use. He was not going to require me to go to AA because I had already tried that. And he helped me with my underlying some depression and with my dealing with addiction, and didn't have stipulations and orders, and let me find my own way out of the drinking problem, and let me make the decision that I needed to quit.
Yeah, so it was an individual approach that fits you.
That's right.
All right,
and he's been in my life for 20 years, so that I could go back to him. It's that continuing care models that our experts have talked about.
Let's take some phone calls at 1-888-477-9499. We have Jennifer on the line, and she works for Living Grin, one of the rehab facilities in our region. Hi, Jennifer. You are on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate very much this conversation being able to happen today. I think it's important that those in our field not be afraid to look at the gap between research and practice, and that we be able to continue to have this conversation. It's long been an issue in our field, and it's something that I know we here at Living Grin are very focused on trying to bridge that gap, continually working to improve and build in evidence-based tools to all of our treatment.
And Jennifer, what are you doing to get the kind of latest research into your practice at Living Grin? Give us some examples.
Sorry, it's Jessica.
Oh, but, Jessica, I'm sorry. Jennifer.
That's okay. It's my older sister's name. It's a lifelong issue. I'll talk about it later. many of the things that have been talked about here, we've worked with TRI here at Living Grin to help incorporate some of those research practices here, beginning with working on screening for co-occurring disorders and being able to offer a track of treatment and focus programming for those who are working with issues of depression or anxiety, as well as dealing with their addiction. Using medication-assisted therapy, as was referenced before here, every patient is screened for if they're appropriate for medication-assisted therapy, and information about those supportive treatments is in our regular programming and given to every patient that comes through, because that is what the research says, that along with treatment, this can be a really helpful tool. Trained clinicians, we do have a variety of levels here, but we have a highly supervised employee training program. We have master's level clinicians at all of our sites. And very important to us is the family component from the door, and offering couples groups for the patients and their significant others, as well as parents groups, so that we can improve the health of the system as they move through our full continuum of care, whether they're here for detox and rehabilitation here, or if they're referred to one of our outpatient sites. We have 8 outpatient sites that do not only an intensive work, but also step down to individual and ongoing therapy.
And one last question, how do you keep track of how your clients are doing once they leave? Because that's a very difficult thing for rehab centers to do, and thus get information on how their program is doing.
It is an ongoing struggle for all of us in the field. I know this is something that's been very important for us, and we've been able to do that with some of our targeted populations. Right now, our primary focus around our high-risk patients that come in from the door, we're identifying they've had multiple treatment streams or are at a high risk. We're tracking them directly with through their treatment, adding additional layers of interventions for them post-discharge, being able to provide weekly, monthly follow-up calls and tracking them through our continuum of care. But holding onto that data is a real issue.
Yeah.
It's really difficult for those in our field.
Thank you so much for your call. Let me get our experts a chance to respond.
So I will say that TRI has worked with Living Grin.
That's the Treatment Research Institute.
Yes,
yeah.
And we're happy to do it. One of the programs they have there is pretty instructive with regard to how the rest of society ought to get treated. They have a very good nursing program for the
nurses.
Many nurses that become addicted in the course of their their work. It's an occupational hazard. Well, doctors, nurses, and airline pilots get 5 years of treatments, not all residential. They get supervised, managed. Their families are educated and supported. They learn how to handle cravings, cues, all the problems for 5 years. And their outcomes are excellent, like 87% excellent outcomes throughout 5 years.
Adam, you also had a response.
Oh, yeah. I was actually going to say that level of monitoring, you know, like, you know, here we have a program that's set up to really monitor patients over the long haul.
Right.
The problem is a lot of the way addiction is paid for. Again, it's going to keep coming back to that. The way we've set this up, programs don't get much. And I would hazard to say that, you know, and Jessica, you can correct me if I'm wrong about this, that you guys don't get reimbursed for those telephone calls where you reach out to patients who are out there. I mean, that's something that you're doing on your own dime to demonstrate, you know, that you're doing well or to check up on a patient. But that should be paid time. That's care. That's treatment. But it's not paid for by most systems. And so, you know, these quality things that could really move our system more into a chronic care model are not yet in place to make it work over the wide spread of treatment.
If I could just add one more thing. Jessica made a great point about how difficult it is to do outcomes. And in our field, it is another example of hearkening back to the old days. You got treatment for 30 days. You left treatment, big graduation ceremony, everybody crying, hugging, best of luck.
It still goes on.
and then you left. And outcomes were judged after treatment was over. Well, that's not how you evaluate the effectiveness of any chronic illness. So the kinds of things Adam was just talking about, indeed Adam and his colleague John Cassiola have developed a way of measuring outcomes while treatment is going on. It's called Recovery Track. And we measure the adjustment of the patient as they're going through outpatient treatment so that you know whether there's improvement and, if there's not, what you can do to improve it.
And you visited these facilities all over the country. If I walk in as a client and I say, what are your outcomes? What will I likely be told?
Well, very few of them have any actual, you know, science-based data. And one of the things people need to understand is, and if they have done studies, there are ways of spinning the data so that it may not be presented. If you really look at it, there's ways to poke holes in it. But what the consumer, what the family member of a loved one who goes for treatment needs to understand is there's an expectation that you go in for treatment, whether it's good treatment or poor quality treatment or long-term treatment, the expectation of the family member is that the person goes in for treatment and they're fixed.
Right.
And they're going to be abstinent, and
that's
they're
right.
not going to use.
Yeah.
Somebody with a chronic addiction, a serious problem, is probably going to relapse, or they may well relapse.
All
treatment
right.
Maybe. Go ahead. We can come back to that.
Yes, yeah, sorry. Hold that thought, Ann Fletcher. We'll be right back in a moment here on Radio Times and take more phone calls at 1-888-477-9499. We'll be back in a moment here on Radio Times.
Penn Medicine supports WHYY. Doctors at Penn's Depression Research Unit have been studying the causes and treatment of mood disorders since 1964 and are currently performing research to develop improved treatments. Symptoms may include mood swings, low energy, and low motivation. Initial evaluations are offered to determine those who are eligible for treatment. More about Penn's Depression Research Unit at 215-662-3462. 215-662-3462.
If your child is being bullied on social media sites by schoolmates, when is it appropriate for you or the school to intervene? That's one of the questions we'll discuss on the next Fresh Air with Emily Bazelon, author of Sticks and Stones, about the culture of bullying and efforts to stop it. Her research took her to homes, schools, courtrooms, and the offices of Facebook. Join us
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. 50 years after Betty Friedan published The Feminine Mystique, family historian Stephanie Kuntz asks why both men and women can't get what they really want. Also, Kelly Willis and Bruce Robison and their modern take on classic country music, they seem happy. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moskowain, and we're talking about addiction treatment. Our guest is Ann Fletcher. She has written Inside Rehab, The Surprising Truth About Addiction Treatment and How to Get Help That Works, and that is her eighth book. We're also joined by addiction researchers Thomas McClellan and Adam Brooks. They are both with the Treatment Research Institute in Philadelphia, and Tom also wrote the introduction for Ann's book. And Ann, before our break here on Radio Times, we were talking about relapse and that it is to be expected on some level. So go ahead, you were just about to.
Well, and we were talking about how do you know what a success rate of a rehab is?
Yeah.
What are their outcomes? And the question is, how do you measure a success rate in an individual person? a better outcome is not just abstinence, not using. It could be using less. It could be a better quality of life. There's so many different ways that a better outcome can be, you know, that it could be measured, and that researchers look at this, and family members don't understand that. And they tend to go to these family education programs, and they learn all about what's called, you know, the disease of addiction. And I sat through several of them, and they're very scary. And they're told things like, if your family member relapses, he or she may die. And they're not given practical strategies for what to do in the very real event that the person might relapse. And we actually have approaches. I mentioned them earlier, the CRAFT program, that teaches people approaches that they can use to work with a loved one who is using or to help get that person into treatment. Often what happens is that person keeps going back to treatment. They're offered the same approaches over and over again. The kinds of models that Dr. Brooks and Dr. McClellan are talking about is a long-term model where people would continue care, not go back to different rehabs. People will hop around all over the country to different programs instead of staying with a group or a therapist who know them. One woman I interviewed went to a very famous rehab and went to their residential program. Then she went to their outpatient program, but it was all short-term, 30 days residential, 6 weeks outpatient. And she said, well, I want to keep staying with my same therapist.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, nope, that's not our model. We don't have a way for you to do that. And it just doesn't make any sense. They said, well, you could start outpatient treatment all over again and sit through the lectures and the videos. Our model isn't set up to do that, and that's what we need, and that's what Tom and Adam are working on, things like that.
Yeah, let's take another call. We have James joining us from South Jersey. Hi, James, you're on Radio Times.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Interesting show. It's good to talk to all of you. I appreciate the opportunity. Couple of points. I am an alcoholic. I drank for 32 years. I am 59 years old, and I've been sober for 10 years. You cannot diminish the AA program. One thing I have to mention, the concept of AA is based on the fact there is no completion. We live in a society that's based on graduation and finishing. It's the hardest thing for people to understand, the ongoingness of this. I've done about 1,500 meetings over 10 years. If you do the math, it's about 3.5 to 4 meetings a week mm-hmm. for the 10-year period. I've never relapsed. We say in the program, there is no graduation. It is ongoing. My experience, this is only my experience, I've listened to hundreds and hundreds of people talk who have been to rehabs. They, by and large, mind you, do not work because there is a sense of completion. People tend to come out and return to their addiction. Bob and Bill, the men who founded this program, along with a few others, in the mid-1930s, hit upon the concept of sharing tragedy with another human who is in a tragic circumstance. That person shares back their tragedy. Something about that mutual sharing absolutely works. I've experienced it. I was a bottom drunk for 32 years. I now have 10 years sobriety. I love the concept of sharing, listening, relating.
Yeah.
It brings about humility and those 12 steps. But people need to understand, the hardest thing to get around is we live in a society of graduation, promotion, and completion.
All right, James, let me jump in there because our experts are all nodding their heads in agreement. So, Adam, let me get you a chance to respond. And thank you, James, for your call.
Absolutely. James, thanks for sharing that. first of all, I mean, I think you'll find amongst all of us that we all have immense respect for AA and Narcotics Anonymous and other fellowships. I mean, I've had, you know, friends and family members that have greatly benefited from it. The other thing I want to point out about AA that I just think is wonderful, it is a volunteer, non-treatment organization that is most like the continuum of care we wish we had.
Yeah.
You can go anywhere in this country and many places overseas and find an AA meeting at almost any time of the day or night that you need it, or to find help through a sponsor or a telephone call. And it's self-dosed. I mean, Anne brought up the fact that a lot of people go to AA and they only go for a while and they don't stay with it forever. Well, guess what? That's an example of self-selection of the continuum of care. People sort of saying, well, I used it as much as I needed it, and then I moved away from it, and I don't benefit from it as much anymore.
Or they go back to it again when they need it.
And in a lot of ways, I mean, I think it's like the shining success of people stepping in where the treatment system did not offer alternatives. And so I would say I would never diminish what AA does. I think that you've got people in there who are lifesavers, who also experience profound personal and spiritual change. And who would want to take that away from anybody? But it doesn't work for everybody.
It's free, but
it doesn't work for everybody. And I think what we need is a treatment system that can mimic the successes that AA has provided, while providing other avenues and options for people that could be as flexible. It'd be halfway as flexible, and I would be happy.
Yeah.
You know, I have just two things to say. First, to James, attaboy, good for you. And the second is, he's completely right. In an era where everybody's looking for a quick fix, some idiot's got holding up a book saying, I've got the cure. It's a total lie. And you're looking for that quick fix. There ain't one. There just ain't. And AA is about the best we've got. It's unfortunately true. It doesn't work for everybody, but it works for a lot of people. And the problem it's always been AA versus the rest of things. It's nuts. It should be AA in addition to medications, AA in addition to family therapy, AA in addition to all kinds of other things that can work and often do.
Or offering a menu so that people can, you know, I can get some medication, I can get my family in here to talk about some issues, I can get some individual therapy, and I can try AA. And getting some good hand-holding during that process. I'm sorry, Anne,
I just wanted to say that, you know, one of the addressing James's point, too, that AA, one of the wonderful things about AA is that it's multidimensional. You know, it addresses many aspects of life. It has cognitive behavioral components, spiritual components. There are lots of wonderful things about it, but I wrote another book about long-term sobriety called Sober for Good about 10 years ago, in which I interviewed hundreds of people who had at least 5 years of sobriety, and they had achieved it in many different ways, many with AA, many without. And one of the things that I heard is that that message that you have to keep going for the rest of your life can be very daunting and threatening to a lot of people. And Dr. Brooks said earlier that not everybody has to do that. Well, first of all, not everybody has to go to AA. But in AA's own materials, one of their best books is a little book called Living Sober. And in that book it says, how long do we need to go to meetings? Only as long as we need them. So not everybody uses it that way.
All right, and we have about 10 minutes left in the show, and there are two things I absolutely want to get to. And part of that is your very helpful advice that you have collected in your book in terms of picking a rehab or a program or a setting that works for you. So let's talk about that. What are some of the questions people should ask, people or their family members should ask, when looking for a course of treatment?
Well, as you know, I have long lists of questions, and you know, I think you have to go through them and kind of think about the things that are most important to you. There's a separate chapter just for families with adolescents. There's a separate chapter for people with co-occurring psychiatric and psychological problems that accompany addiction. And at least half of people with addiction have those problems. And so that would be one of the questions to ask. Now, unfortunately, many, I would venture to say most programs, say they treat those problems, but don't necessarily treat them adequately. And that's and those problems need to be addressed in order for problems with addiction to really be treated effectively. So you want to ask questions about who's on staff? What are the qualifications of the people on staff? What percentage of the time that I'm in treatment will I see an individual therapist or counselor? How much time will I get with a doctoral-level psychologist if I have an accompanying psychiatric or psychological problem? What are the qualifications of my primary counselor? That would be the person who I see who provides the bulk of my care. One of the huge wake-up calls in writing this book was that, and this was done by another group called Casa Columbia, is a kind of a think tank group in New York, and they did a big survey of addiction programs all across the country and looked at qualifications of addiction counselors. That's who provides most of the treatment at treatment programs. They found that 30 states do not require a college degree, a bachelor's degree, for somebody to become certified or licensed as an addiction counselor. So a lot of our treatment in this country is not being provided by qualified people. So find out. Experts I interviewed said a minimum of a master's degree, certainly a bachelor's degree, you want to find out the qualifications of the people providing your care.
And so how do you go about
starter questions?
Right, that's just to get started. And then you should probably also think about the continuum of care at the start. So, Tom, what should you ask? What should you plan for the time when you get out?
Well, among the things that Anne talks about, and which are all very, very good, I think two very important ones are, what are the plans for continuing care now? The stories that I unfortunately have heard, Anne, I'm sure has many, many more, of particularly parents dropping Johnny off, finally getting him into the rehab, no contact, and like 14 days later they get a call, come pick up Johnny, and they have no idea what to do. So that's when care really starts. We've said it about 30 times, here's 31. You've got to make sure that following whatever that initial period of stabilization, learning, is a period of continuing care, and you need care for the family. The family is going to be, has to learn how to manage, has to monitor, has to learn how to support, but also do so with real limits.
Yeah, I would say, I think one thing that any family member that's trying to get their loved one into a program should at the same time be shopping for a mental health professional who they could consider supplementing that care with. Because I think a lot of times, and Anne's experience is instructive, I think a lot of times, you know, you need somebody who is going to be there over the long haul, who can handle a variety of issues. And they are out there. You know, I said, you know, a lot of times, you know, the mental health professional will refer them out. But that is changing. I mean, I have a list of at least five or six people that are go-to people that I'll refer family members or friends to, who provide very flexible addiction and mental health care, who can be with somebody over the long term.
And how do families manage the insane cost of all of this? I mean, reading your book, my jaw was dropping.
Oh, wow. I have a whole chapter on that.
Yes, and we don't
have
a whole lot of time, but
who were wiped out by it, just wiped out. Well, first of all, let's back up. First of all, the knee-jerk reaction when somebody has a serious, mild, moderate, or severe problem doesn't have to be go to rehab, doesn't have to be go to a treatment program. I mean, certainly if it's really severe and somebody needs a detox, you know, but most problems are not starting out at that level. So I'm going to jump on something that Adam said, which is there are more and more mental health professionals who have these qualifications. I live in a small university city, and right off the top of my head, I can think of two mental health professionals, and I'm sure there are more, who are qualified where you could go in for an assessment. Okay, if I had somebody in my life right now with a substance problem, I wanted to know how severe it was, that's where I'd start. Not with a place that has a vested interest in admitting my loved one in treatment. I'd get an independent assessment from that mental health professional who also has expertise with addictions, who could assess how serious the problem is, and then direct the care from there. Would an outpatient program be appropriate? Does this person truly need residential? Or would one-on-one care be fine for now? I have Blue Cross Blue Shield. Now, not everybody has care that good, but my Blue Cross Blue Shield would pay for that mental health professional to see a person once a week, twice a week. So it doesn't have to be going to rehab that is extremely costly.
And we have about a minute left. Tom, what are some things that make you hopeful that addiction treatment is improving, that it will become more available to more people?
Two things. First is the emerging science. We know a lot more about addiction and substance use disorders than we ever have, and we're learning more every day. But most importantly is the Affordable Care Act. It will transform the treatment of substance use disorders in a way that's never happened my whole life.
And Adam, what are you thinking? What makes you hopeful?
Oh, I was going to second Tom on the Affordable Care Act. I mean, the way the treatment system is set up, where is the money going? Who's paying for the treatment? Where does it come from? Who benefits when somebody goes into treatment? The Affordable Care Act gives us room to take a harder look at that and to reorganize quality around financial success in the field.
And I guess taking a lesson from your book, we as consumers also have to be more demanding and informed about what kind of care we need and want.
We do, and I have also seen signs that rehabs are changing since I visited the program several years ago, and I've seen positive change for the better.
All right.
That's great.
And that's Anne Fletcher. She has written Inside Rehab, The Surprising Truth About Addiction Treatment and How to Get Help That Works. Thank you so much for joining us today. And we were also joined by addiction researchers Thomas McClellan and Adam Brooks, and they are both of the Treatment Research Institute in Philadelphia. You've been listening to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott, filling in for Marty Moskowain. Thank you so much for joining us today.